This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
He really is an advocate for the citizen scientist, and he's promoting tiger beetles, I think in part as a way to promote that very idea, again, of an educated public, a public that cares about tiger beetles and butterflies and flowers and ecology and ecosystems.
Getting back to the roots, what does it really mean? This week on Sea Change Radio, we feature two women who have each recently penned pieces for Orion Magazine about movements to connect people with nature. First, we hear from Lauren Markham, who's chronicled the new generation of hipster farmers, or farmsters. More and more educated young people are thumbing their noses at corporate America and instead working the land. We talk about the impact they're having on modern agriculture and how it will affect the food we eat. Next, I speak with Sharman Russell about citizen science, a trend where traditional scientists are embracing crowdsourcing as a way to improve their data. We'll examine the phenomenon through the author's own contributions as a citizen scientist assisting the study of tiger beetles. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by author Lauren Markham. Lauren, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much.
So you have a piece in the latest Orion magazine called The New Farmers. Why don't you talk first about what this movement is?
Yeah, so this I was interested in writing this piece because I'm 31 and I have an increasing number of friends around my same age and a little bit younger who are going into the farming profession. And these folks tend to be more privileged farmers than we have seen in generations past, and tend to be younger farmers who are taking over, they're not people who are taking over their family farms. They're farmers by choice who often don't have heritage in farming, or at least not recent heritage. Many of us have farming, you know, generations back. And so this article is really exploring, like, what is this movement? What does it look like? Why are people choosing this this vocation, this profession? Especially, you know, folks who have really educated backgrounds and who have many opportunities. I was really excited to see so many people choosing farming over other professions, as opposed to choosing farming because that's what their family has always done.
Is it just the type of people that are getting into farming right now are from educated backgrounds and not inheriting their family farms? Or is there a real demographic shift? Are we seeing real numbers of people who are adopting working on the land as a vocation?
Yeah, it's still a vast minority, but the numbers really are shifting. So in the most recent agricultural census, which was in 2012, that census showed that between 2007 and 2012, the number of young beginning farmers increased almost 12%. So it's on the rise.
And for people who are not subscribers to Modern Farmer magazine,
yeah.
What does that depict and what can we glean from it?
From the magazine itself?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's this really interesting magazine, and I've actually written for it, full disclosure. I've written for their website. Modern Farmer is almost like a lifestyle magazine that's focusing on farming and agriculture. And so it's this sort of like very, it's a lifestyle magazine. It's portraying farming as very sexy and chic. Farming has this appeal. I write about this in the piece. It's sort of nostalgic and hip at the same time. And you know, I imagine that could feel for people who've been farming for a very long time and, who have been struggling in farming for a very long time. I wonder if that sort of aesthetic might seem either ridiculous or insulting. But certainly what it is doing is it's calling more attention. I mean, we see this nationwide with in the food movement, that the food movement is helping calling more attention to agriculture, and we're paying more attention to where our food comes from and the people who grow our food, and we're paying more attention as a country to sourcing our food and to the fact that people are actually growing and picking our food, and that it doesn't just sort of magically appear on our plates or on our grocery store shelves.
So these are generally farmers in their 20s and 30s who are going into it and haven't really had the the quote-unquote real-life financial issues that a lot of the hard-scrabble farmers that we tend to associate with from multi-generational farms that go back to the Dust Bowl. Will these next generation of farmers be able to succeed with the current policy the way it is, or are they going to have to be the leaders to forge a new structure or landscape that will enable farmers to live well off the fruits of the labor? You give an example of one of these people who calculated that they're only making $5 an hour. That's pretty hard work to be making sub-minimum wage salary.
It's an incredibly hard scrabble life. I mean, not on Dust Bowl proportions, but it's incredibly challenging and incredibly difficult. Even for folks who start with some capital, who start with land, and you know, folks who are 25, and don't have children can, lead a certain kind of life with certain kind of financial limitations. Once you start to have kids, that might start shifting. So it's incredibly difficult. I talked to many folks, and I talked to some of the leaders of the Greenhorns. Severin von Scharner Fleming is the director of the Greenhorns organization, which is, it's basically a movement that it's kind of a resource sharing and networking organization that connects new beginning farmers who are often young farmers with one another, helping to, you know, advocate, lobby, share best practices, and helping kind of help these new beginning farmers feel like they're not alone. And I think that the movement and the growing numbers is where the hope and possibility is. That sort of was my takeaway, that in en masse, you can advocate for better policies. You can advocate for better food policies, for better agricultural policies. You can advocate for access. You can network and share resources, share farm equipment, share land. So I think that the hope in the kind of shift comes in the growing numbers, for sure. Severin von Scharner Fleming also brought up a really interesting point to me about privilege, because I had asked that question about privilege. You know, like what does it mean that we're seeing folks of privilege going into this when farm into farm ownership and farm operation, when for decades and centuries, really, that the farm workers and the farm laborers, the people who are picking the food, are often incredibly underprivileged people in California. I think it's about 65% of the farm labor is undocumented immigrants. So those kind of complicated dynamics of privilege of this new emerging class of farmers. And she said, well, you know, the fact is that actually can be a positive thing. The fact that people of privilege who are frankly used to getting their way, who the system, they were born into systems that are inherently skewed toward favoring folks of privilege, that those folks can actually start shifting the system for everybody, and that actually could be a really positive and hopeful thing.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Lauren Markham. She has a new piece in Orion Magazine called The New Farmers. So I want to turn to what a lot of older people will associate the younger generation with, and that's technology.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the farms that I profiled, Sweet Root Farms, which is in the Penn Valley of California, I spent about an hour and a half out there in the fields interviewing Dina Miller, who's one half of the farm operating duo. And she had, you know, I talk about this in the piece, she had her kind of tool belt, and she had all of these farm tools and all of this stuff hanging off her belt, and she had her cap and she had her, you know, gloves, and she was out there weeding when I came to meet her. She also had a very well-protected iPhone in there that was binging, you know, throughout our interview. And at the end she said, oh, look, I've gotten 5 orders just in the past hour. So she's out there in the fields weeding carrots while she's also taking orders for, you know, someone had contacted her about arranging flowers for a wedding, and someone else had contacted about a CSA. So it's this really fascinating thing of this kind of direct access. And it takes out, there's the opportunity of really taking out the middleman, which of course then increases profit and increases that, you know, again, what a lot of these farmers are after is going back to a sense of connection to our foods. That if you know your farmers, you understand your food more. And I think that that's, you know, it's not just about the capital the technology. It's not, the technology isn't just positive because of the access to capital. That's incredibly important, but it's also about that connection, that direct connection between the buyers and the farmers.
And generation aside, let's just talk about small versus big farming. How can big agriculture set this movement back? And has it put any kind of policies, or has it been lobbying for any specific policies to take this movement out at the knees, if you will?
So I'm not totally sure that this movement is a big enough threat to big agriculture yet. The numbers are still incredibly small. Even though the growth is astounding, the overall numbers are incredibly small. I mean, just talking about organic, this was a shocking statistic to me, and I live in the Bay Area, so I'm like kind of in a bubble here, but organic represented only 4% of the total national sales in 2012. That's not big or large, that's just organic. Most of the small farms tend to be organic. Most of these, you know, everyone that I talked to and profiled have organic practices, but it's only 4% of the national total. And a lot of organic sellers are these big industrial agricultural companies. So I just don't think that the numbers are big enough yet that the big agricultural companies are going to, you know, try to take these younger farmers out at the knees. I think, though, that the system and structure, like we were talking about earlier, is just so skewed to economies of scale, also so skewed to just the status quo of these bigger operations.
I'd be curious to know that 4%, what it was a decade ago. I remember hearing statistics not so long ago that sounded much less significant. 4% is starting to make a dent in the type of foods we eat.
Oh, absolutely. That's that number. Thank you for saying that. It's up 183% from 2007. So it's absolutely growing. It's just the overall numbers are still so small. And, you know, that number is not disaggregated for small versus large farms.
Right. And when you think about the way we eat food, as opposed to going to your grocery store and eating and picking out your vegetables, as opposed to the vegetables that are going into canned soup and getting sent all over the world, it starts, if you start comparing apples to apples and the way they're distributed, it's not insignificant. It's probably much, much higher than 4%, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just to kind of give an example of, you know, the economy of scale, and kind of just an example of something that I learned of how the sort of system is skewed toward the economy of scale. So I spoke with Matthew Shapiro, who is the owner and operator of Buckeye Ranch, which is a lamb operation in Grass Valley, California. Sorry, in Penn Valley, California. And he has such a small operation, and he is not allowed to slaughter his own animals. So he feeds his animals, raises his animals, but he is not allowed to directly sell meat.
So why is that?
So in order to sell his meat, he has to have it, you know, in order to be above board, which of course he wants to do, he has to have his animals slaughtered at a USDA approved facility. And so he has to pay and transport his animals to be slaughtered by somebody else at quite a high cost. That's of course cheaper at scale, and then transport them back and sell them directly at the farmer's market himself. So he is not able to, you know, he as much as he got into farming in order to kind of see the entire life cycle of the animal through, there's this critical part, right, the death of these animals that he's been caring for that he is not allowed to participate in. And in fact, he has to pay somebody else to do.
The piece in Orion Magazine is called The New Farmers, author Lauren Markham. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Sitting, singing songs for everyone. Sit beside a mountain stream, see her waters rise. Listen to the pretty sound music as she flies.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by author Sharman Russell. Sharman, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
So you've written a book called Diary of a Citizen Scientist, and you also have a new piece in the latest Orion magazine about citizen science. Define citizen science for us first.
Yeah, well, you know, it's always been around a long time. Darwin used citizen scientists, kind of amateurs, you know, working class men and women to help him collect his data. Then we really entered an area of specialization in science, I think, and really had this line between the expert and the amateur, the scientist and the non-scientist. But there's been this wonderful kind of revolution and renaissance in the past few decades in terms of citizen science. So the citizen scientist is the not relatively untrained, unprofessional, non-scientist who is doing science and is working with scientists now on just all kinds of projects all over the world.
And you are a avid tiger beetle scientist now. And without giving too much away out of your piece, Meet the Beetles, explain a little bit more on how the traditional science community has embraced not only you, but your colleagues and gives you some real tasks to help in their work.
Right, right. I've really found the scientific community to be very generous. I think they really see the powerful role that citizen scientists play, not only in doing good research and in getting some very, you know, big research projects done, you know, landscape scale projects, you know, continent-wide projects, where you just have hundreds of thousands of people, participating in your research, but also in terms of policy. They understand that an educated public is what they need. So when I wrote David Pearson, who's the co-author of A Field Guide to Tiger Beetles in the United States and Canada, just a question about tiger beetles, he emailed right back, you know, right that afternoon. Within a week, he was telling me to go in the field and study these particular species of tiger beetles because he had in his field guide a little blank spot. For the western red-bellied tiger beetle, the larval biology was unknown. So he wanted me to fill in that blank spot. And he's doing that with many people all over the country, luring them in and getting them out to do field work.
And why don't you, beyond the tiger beetle work, why don't you give some examples of where citizen scientists are making an impact?
You know, a lot of it is through crowdsourcing. You have these huge programs online. Galaxy Zoo is one example where people are classifying galaxies. And this is enabling astronomers to have these big sample sizes of spiral-shaped galaxies and elliptical-shaped galaxies. And they need those in order to do their research. There are 500 billion galaxies in the universe, possibly. And we have millions and millions of images of unclassified galaxies. So I think nearly a million people have participated in Galaxy Zoo, classifying galaxies and helping astronomers do this research. And that's just one example of many crowdsourcing programs online. But for someone like me, I'm online a lot as a writer and a teacher. I really want to get offline. I want to get out in the natural world. And there are also hundreds and thousands of people out there doing those kinds of projects. I think there's some like 200,000 people working with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, looking and monitoring birds. And the list goes on. Almost any area you can think of these days are starting to use citizen scientists and bringing them in, in multiples of thousands.
And how much do you attribute this to people wanting to get back to the land in an age of increasing speed and urbanization? And how much do you give technology credit for connecting people this way?
It's an amazing synergy. The technology has allowed the science to really happen. So, for example, I'm in a program called Nature's Notebook. Thousands of people across America go out in their backyard and they're looking at the life cycle of plants that they've identified. So I'm looking at mesquite and I'm looking at honey locust and I'm looking at four-winged saltbush, how it changes through the years, when it leaves out, when it fruits. And again, that's being duplicated. So that fulfills my desire to get to know my world better, to live in place and to kind of fall in love with where I live. But I can put that data on a national database, and that allows Nature Notebook to look at the big picture. So because we can do that kind of collective work, because it can all be organized by technology, it makes it really useful and fruitful.
And this technology, just to clarify for our listeners, this technology is, you don't necessarily have to have the latest iPhone, or you don't even have to be basically computer literate. I think of my father-in-law, who's an amateur ornithologist, and he is not somebody who has embraced technology in any way, but I've been pulled into his study and I won't say made, but urged to watch the mating habits of an eagle or a falcon that's on a webcam. This is somebody who's a technophobe, but this technology is enabling him to be part of a much bigger community.
Absolutely. I mean, he just needs to go to the internet. Like, you know, all scientists collect information. They record, they observe, and then they share it. And so he just has to be able to record his data online. And citizen science projects are increasingly, amazingly user-friendly. They're geared for the general public. Of course, a lot of them are also want to bring in school children, people of all ages. So your father-in-law can really be brilliant at recognizing birds and at watching for them. And in terms of his information, he just needs to go online in the most simplest way.
And as science departments around the country are scrambling for grant money and other funding, do you see citizen science to be a boon for them, or is it something that might lead to them getting less funding because they're getting more and more help from the public?
Oh, more funding if they're smart enough to do citizen science projects. David Pearson told me without a hint of chagrin that the traditional roles of biologist are more and more being taken up by citizen scientists. They're going out there with their field guides and they're watching for the distribution of plants and animals. But there just aren't enough biologists to do that. There aren't enough professionally trained people to look at how this planet is changing with climate change, of course, and to help document and protect it. So we need everyone. And, you know, science departments know this. I mean, if they can get 100,000 people to help them with a research question, that's just to their benefit. So they just need to design, and they are doing that, programs and research questions that incorporate crowdsourcing and incorporate the new citizen scientist.
Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Sharman Russell. Her new piece in Orion Magazine is Meet the Beatles. Let me read you this quote from the piece. It says, "All around the world, people of all ages and backgrounds are dedicating countless hours to monitoring such things as juniper pollen, kestrels, salamanders, horseshoe crabs, black swans, river otters, osprey, hedgehogs, sunflowers, loons, comets, bacteria, solar flowers, and roadkill. The sheer number of citizen science combined with new technology is changing how certain research gets done." Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about some of those examples.
It's so hard to pick one. You know, the contrast I'd love to talk about is the micro project. So, you know, there are projects that have you monitor and look at the microbes in your belly button. There are projects that have you monitor and look at the microbes in your kitchen. And this is all about looking at that whole other world out there and how microbe communities change and flourish and evolve. But then I'm also thinking, here's, you know, it's Christmas, holiday season time, and the Christmas bird count is happening right now. Last year, I think over 71,000 people participated in this project in which you go out for one day and look at birds in a certain area. So, and that's been an enormous help to other reports on climate change, because of course the Audubon Christmas bird count has been going on since 1900. So it's the longest running citizen science project, and it offers so much in terms of that long time frame of how the migration of birds and the diversity and the health of birds is changing over time.
Sharman, if you can actually walk us through the real nitty-gritty of what David Pearson asked you to do for his research in tiger beetles.
Sure. So all tiger beetles share certain characteristics. They have three larva stages or instars that pupate, and then there's the adult beetle. But what no one knows is where the female went to lay her eggs and what kind of habitat. And no one had officially seen those first two instars and described them. So I collected the western red-bellied tiger beetle. I put him and her in my terrariums, watched them mate. Apparently that's kind of a fun thing to do in nature studies. And I was able to rear up the larva and then to describe them. And now I have to confess that it's pretty mysterious where these thousands of tiger beetles go to lay their eggs. So I'm still looking for that. And I've done a variety of different kinds of observational experiments to try and figure that out.
Two of the things that I thought of when I read David Pearson asking you to do this was, A, why didn't he do this himself? And B, was he asking lots of people to do this?
Well, there's just so much for him to do. He and his co-author, Barry Nicely of the Field Guide, had tried rearing up the western red-bellied tiger beetle during one of their experiments, and it just hadn't proved successful. So then he went on. He goes to Peru, he goes to Madagascar, he goes, you know, all over looking at tiger beetles and helping assess the biodiversity of an area based on the diversity of tiger beetles. Is he asking a lot of people? Well, he's asking a few, yeah. He really is an advocate for the citizen scientist, and he's promoting tiger beetles, I think in part as a way to promote that very idea, again, of an educated public, a public that cares about tiger beetles and butterflies and flowers and ecology and ecosystems. David Pearson is really a conservation biologist, and he believes that unless scientists reach out to the general public, unless they, you know, kind of abandon their jargon and form a collaborative partnership with the public, they're never really going to reach their goals, which is to conserve the world, to protect it, to, you know, in some way fall in love with it.
Author Sharman Russell, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks so much.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Bobby Humphrey, The Beatles, and Simon & Garfunkel. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.